Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
To another great episode we have for Suspense Radio. It's great to be back after a couple 3-week layoff, and we only have a couple more shows to the end of the year. Once we finish out November, we will be taking the month of December off, and we'll be back on January. But Crime and Science Radio will be able to fill the spots here on the Saturday. And if you haven't checked that show out, make sure you go to suspensemagazine.com, click on the Crime and Science Radio banner hosted by DT Lyle and Jan Burke, and find out everything behind the scenes that you have to do, whether you're a fan or an author, to see what's real, what's not real, what's right in the courtroom, what's not in the courtroom. All the stuff that they cover is fabulous, so check that out. Today's guests we have are going to be three of the outstanding guests here, because we always say in suspense, mystery, thriller, and horror, that we always try to bring you different kinds of eclectic authors from within that genre. We have three outstanding ones today, and we are pleased right now to bring back our friend and great author, Tasha Alexander, to the show with her eighth book now in the Lady Emily series called Behind the Shattered Glass. So, Tasha, thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm good, John. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, and it's always, like we said, we only do this once a year, and that's a damn shame because, you know, you can only write so much. But we're always happy when we see Lady Emily back here on the pages and on the shelf. And so you got to give us a little update. Now, she's now through book 8, so now you're starting to get into that time when the series kind of changes a little bit and things start manifesting in a different way. So give us a little behind-the-scenes action of now Behind the Shattered Glass.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do in the course of the series was bring Emily from coddled, spoiled society girl to developing into a more mature, intellectual, enlightened citizen of the world, so to speak, someone with a social conscience and someone who's not just obsessed with balls in London and things like that. And Behind the Shattered Glass, what I really wanted to do was see the downstairs of a great estate in England. You know, so many of us are enamored with the idea of the English country estate, and, you know, these beautiful rooms on beautiful grounds and a wonderful lifestyle that is only made possible by the servants who are running the household. Emily's servants, particularly her butler, Davis, and her lady's maid, Meg, have been in many of the books in the series, but we always see them from Emily's point of view. And I really wanted us to see, for example, Davis, instead of being in his yes, madam, bring the port mode, I wanted us to see him below stairs where he's the head honcho. He's the boss of mm-hmm. everyone. Because you can't really understand that whole society without understanding what the servants' lives are like.
Right. And so, and for people that are new to the series, when they're hearing you talking, they're like, what do you mean, English country, estates, servants, things like that? Your books are set in a Victorian time, which, of course, is much different than a lot of the suspense thriller books out there today, with the CSI and the DNA and the cell phones and everything else. You have to use, and Lady Emily actually has to use, detective intellectual intelligence in order to solve crimes, sort of the way that the Hercule Poirot's did in the Miss Jane Marples and the things back in that. So give everybody, like I said, who haven't really, you know, found you or kind of gotten into you, the setting behind, you know, Lady Emily, where she's at and kind of, you know, how all that world kind of works together.
Sure. So Emily is a young woman who's married to Colin Hargreaves, who is an agent for Queen Victoria. His exact role is never specified completely because he's kind of so covert that they're not even supposed to, you're not even supposed to know that he's an agent. But as a result of being married to him, Emily can get caught up in a variety of different cases to help her husband investigate, and sometimes often, in fact, she winds up taking the lead. The books are all set in the 1890s, and many of them are in England, but I like to send Emily to different places in the world so that she gets a broader experience. But in this one, we are at the couple's country estate, so it's the home where Colin would have grown up, because of course these houses go from father to son. And Emily has just had two babies. She's had twin boys, so rather than trotting off across the continent or something, she really needs to be at home for a little while. One would hope peacefully relaxing with the new babies, but alas, that is not to be, because her mother, Lady Bromley, who has distinctly different ideas about child rearing than Emily does, has come to stay with the family and is interfering as much as she possibly can. Fortunately, or unfortunately for the victim, when the book opens, a gentleman staggers into the library through the open French doors. He's dressed in full evening kit, and he collapses dead on the carpet. Now, Lady Bromley is very upset about this because she's convinced that the blood stain will never come out of the carpet. Mm-hmm. But Emily is always happy, isn't maybe the right word, because you can't be happy that someone's been murdered, but she's always willing and able to help with an investigation. So she and her husband have to figure out why this man is dead, who killed him, and how.
And the one thing that is fabulous, you know, about your books is, you know, you have here, and you're in book 8 now of the series. And so when a lot of people look at that and they say, oh, you know, do I have to go back and read the whole thing? Absolutely not, because the great thing that you have is just because you're now through book 8 and you're going forward, you pretty much start with a blank canvas throughout. Because when people, you know, just when they read the back of the book and it kind of says, you know, who has the motive for murder? You know, is it the lovely cousin? Is it the friend? Is it the scheming vigor? I mean, you still have to bring all these characters into a brand new novel. So it's almost like you're starting with a whole blank canvas, having to create these stories really out of nothing, just out of your, just totally out of air.
Yeah, well, I always want it to be that a reader could, you know, be browsing in their favorite bookstore and see whatever the latest book is, because you're more likely to see the latest one sitting out. And I don't want them to feel like they can't just dive in there. On the other hand, I like to have some bits in there that if you have read from the beginning, you know, you kind of get the inside joke sort of thing, but you're not going to miss out if you're starting in the middle.
Right, and I think that that's kind of, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and you know, it's with a series with this many books, you wind up with a wonderful cast of characters that you can pull from, you know, and I would love to bring back more of the characters from the earlier novels, but you know, you can't have them all at once, and then you also want to have new people. So it's fun to kind of get a balance with that and see who you're going to bring back and who you've got to save for another book.
So in Behind the Shattered Glass, give us a couple of those new characters that you're really excited about and you really think that the fans are excited about and will be excited about when they kind of read about them.
Well, I can tell you that from literally the day the book came out last week, I have had a flood of emails from readers who love Lily. Lily is a parlor maid in the house, and she's a lovely girl. She's very content working in service. She wants to do what a lot of men and women in that time period, if you decided to pursue a life in service, she wants to work her way up to being housekeeper on a great estate eventually. And, you know, as much as the servant situation is so odd to us in the 21st century, you know, in the 19th century, it was a really honorable job, an honorable way of life, and you could actually earn fairly decent money. I read a lot about servants who, when they retired, had a tidy little sum that they had.
Yes.
And they would be pensioned. They would be given a pension by the person they worked for. They'd usually be set up in a cottage on the estate. So it could be a really nice life. Now, of course, it's a really nice life, right. Nice life where you're cleaning stuff all the time, and it's a very
right.
difficult, hard life. But it's not a terrible life. So Lily is in that mode, but as the book goes on, she starts to become friendly with one of the house guests, who is Colin Hargrave's best friend. And I wanted to include that because, you know, I had known initially that I wanted to show us some of the servants' lives. But as I started reading and doing research, I found story after story after story of upstairs, downstairs romances that didn't always wind. I mean, we sort of think, oh, well, either A, that could never happen, or B, well, if it did ever happen, the consequences would be disastrous. So what I found in researching was that there were quite a few people who wound up marrying maids, who younger sons of dukes, whose father set them up with their maid, you know, provided a household for them when they decided that they were in love and wanted to get married. Now, it wouldn't be an easy life because society would be scandalized, but it certainly did happen. And so I wanted to kind of play with that idea of the interaction between a person from upstairs and a person from downstairs without having it be a really terribly exploitative one. So Lily finds herself in this friendship with Colin's friend. So she's a fun character. She was fun to write. She's spirited. She's smart. But she's very limited because, you know, she hasn't had any of the opportunities that someone, say, like Emily would have. She's not going to have had much of an education. She's never going to have traveled, but she's got big dreams. And I think we can all relate to having things that we'd like to do, but that we feel like we're limited by our circumstances and might not ever get to do them. So Lily is, you know, readers have seemed to have fallen in love with Lily. Another person, a character, I guess they're not really people, are they? Another
well, you
character.
Know, they're kind of people. I mean, they've been with you for so long now. I mean, heck.
It's true. And, you know, you spend a lot of time with them when you're writing.
Yeah.
But the other character who I really had a lot of fun with is Emily's neighbor, Matilda. And it is her
right.
cousin who has been murdered. And Matilda is a more radical version of Emily, maybe. I mean, they both are very pro-women's rights, but Matilda wants to sort of go set things on fire while Emily wants to sit down and argue with people about why they're wrong. But Matilda, she likes to fence. She loves the estate that she lives on. But the problem is that Montague Manor, the estate, when her cousin is murdered, the estate has to go to the next male heir in line. And if for a brief moment, it looks like there isn't a male, so in which case the estate would go to Matilda. And she would actually mm-hmm. be the marchioness in her own right and have control over the estate. And so that looks great for Matilda until the long-lost heir returns from the New World, where he has been searching for treasure, and comes to inherit. And Matilda does not believe that he is who he claims he is, that he has any right to the estate. And Emily thinks that, you know, it's a little convenient that the cousin has been killed and Matilda thought she was going to inherit. So you get a whole convoluted kind of problem for Matilda there. She looks pretty guilty, and maybe she is. But she was
yeah.
really fun to write. She was very fun to write.
I mean, and that's the fun part is, it's like everybody's got a motive, but who's got the strongest one? Who's the one who's willing to take that step? And when you're sitting there and constructing the book, and I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author Tasha Alexander, and you can visit her website at TashaAlexander.com for more information. And you also said, before I go back to my point, you said one thing that was very interesting. When you say the upstairs and the downstairs, you're speaking of classes. And
that's
I think
right.
a lot of people in the United States might not realize. They're like, what do you mean? Somebody lives upstairs and somebody lives downstairs? Because, you know, we're so literal over here
right.
that, you know, we're like, what do you mean they live upstairs and they live downstairs? Yeah, so it's like, it's the class thing. And, but, yeah, and that's always funny. But so, back to my point, kind of, you know, everybody's kind of got the motive. And so when you are writing, you kind of have to pick out that one person that will take that leap and actually commit the murder instead of thinking about, God, I wish this person was dead. Do you try to get conflicted? Like, you know, oh, I don't want the nice person to do it, or I can't have it so obvious it's the evil person. How does that thought process go about when you decide that you're going to, that this is the killer?
Well, generally, I start off with the killer. So I have already decided who the killer is. And one of the things that is most important to me when I'm first starting to feel my way through a new book is to figure out the motive. Not just the motive, but like what you were saying, it's such a smart observation. It is, you can have a reason for wanting someone dead or wishing someone was dead, but you have to go from that motive to that extra something that actually makes you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that piece is so, so important before you start writing, to know what is it that made this person cross that line, because who has not said, oh, I wish he would just die?
Right.
We don't really mean it, though. Well, there, some people do. So I always start with that. And then as I start to construct the story, it's around that villain and knowing who that villain is and what that villain would be doing, because generally murderers don't want to be caught. So a lot of the driving force of the narrative has to be the murderer behaving in whatever way he or she has chosen to try to stay, to escape the arms of justice.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, which is much different than a regular thriller, because they're not like, you know, I mean, this is without a doubt a mystery to who done it, you know, what. And the villains are not these evil people that when you're reading the book, you're like, God, were they just, you know, God, I wish they'd catch the guy or they'd kill the guy because he's causing somebody. They're not like that. It's not like that at all. And that's a lot different when you're constructing characters.
Yeah, well, I've always been, you know, I like villains who aren't just the sociopath, who's not just somebody who just, you know, thinks it's actually fun to kill people or is just evil. I like thinking about what is it that it takes to get an ordinary person to kill someone. You know, somebody who, before this act, had been pretty normal, who you never would say, hey, that person is, you know, a time bomb waiting to go off. I like it to be that you take a normal person and push them until they do something in unspeakably bad. Because I think it's more interesting for me as a reader. I like reading a book where the villain is somebody that, of course, you say, wow, crossed a line, shouldn't have done that. But in the back of your mind, you think, but I understand why he or she did it.
Right. And that's always the thing. Yeah, like you said, how many times have you been on the freeway and somebody cuts you off? You're like, oh, man, I just wish I could just drive that. And some people actually do leave their car and shoot them. And you're just wondering, how much of a weird mind do you have to literally get out of the car and just shoot somebody? Someone you don't even know for cutting you off. So that's the interesting dynamic that mystery writers like yourself have to kind of come across, is that dynamic. Because it's easy, not really easy, but you can kind of write that sociopath thriller guy who's just totally out of his whacked out mind. And that's kind of easier to write than the person, like you said, underlying, figuring out that murder is the only way that they can solve their own problems and try to get away with it.
Because I think that often people who do kill someone really think they're justified in having done it. They think there was no other option. They think, and sometimes there is no other option. And
the thing is scary.
And the thing with this book, it's hard to talk about without giving away the end, so I don't want to do that. But, but one of the things that I really wanted to do with this book was, you know, so much of it is about that class system. And, you know, we've all heard stories about, you know, the upper-class gentleman who literally gets away with murder because, you know, we don't want to embarrass the family. There are, of course, all those rumors, I mean, really largely unfounded, that one of the princes was Jack the Ripper, and that's why the case was never solved, because, of course, the palace wouldn't allow it to be. Now, that one is really not true, but there's a lot of that when you read the history, that, you know, this idea that the upper classes can get away with things. So I wanted to play with that notion a little bit. I shouldn't say more, or I'll give it away.
I was waiting. I'm like, is she going to keep coming? Oh, she stopped. So, so when you're looking back at the series, and, you know, you started off, you know, and Only to Deceive, and you kind of worked your way back, and you just had Death in the Floating City, and then you had A Crimson Warning. And now things have kind of progressed, like I said, through book eight. Do you start thinking as an author, okay, you know what, I'm gonna start changing, really change things up. I'm really going to, you know, make things a little more dynamic or move things around a little bit. Because your series, though, is much different than, like I said, like a regular series, you know, like a Jack Reacher or something where it's just one guy going through because there's always something within. But what would be like a shakeup for you, something that you would want to just shake it up and get things like make the reader like go, wow, I had no idea that was coming.
Yeah, that's always the challenge with a series. Once you get past a few books, you know, you want to shake things up. But I think there's a really fine balance between keeping things fresh and then going off in a direction that's so different that, that the readers go, what? You know, I don't want to change Emily fundamentally. What I try to do is put her in very different situations. And, in fact, the book that will be out next year really does go in a different direction. It's pretty creepy. And it's got two storylines that intersect at the end, but it's structurally a little different from the previous ones. It was really, really fun to write.
Yeah, so you're in the middle of it right now, or you
I've finished it. I've finished it. It's done and ready to go. But but I wanted to, because, you know, the things that I didn't want to do was I didn't want to, I mean, for example, I let Emily get remarried very early on in the series because I didn't want to rely on that kind of push and pull romantic tension to drive the book, because that just drives me crazy personally when I'm reading if it goes on too long. And I don't want it to be that Emily and Colin have to fight all the time, because I feel like that is, again, that's manufacturing tension that really doesn't have to have anything to do with the story. And by this point in the series, Emily and Colin have come to a point where they've figured out how they can work together, doing investigations, treating each other as equals within the context of their society. You know, and I don't want to – I always feel like it's the lazy way out if I just throw some problem between them to make the reader worry. So I try to think of things that are exterior to them, to the two of them. I want them to stay solid, but the world around them to do all kinds of crazy things.
So that, now that the book's been out only about a week, what is the one kind of thing that you are getting from fans? What's the one thing that they're giving to you that you are surprised with?
I was really delighted by how and surprised by how much they seem to like the ending. They really, I think people are getting they understand the point I was trying to make with that, with the ending. When regarding, this is so impossible because like I said before, I don't want to give the end away, but that they're getting that class, that the commentary about the classes with that ending.
Okay, good.
And, you know, when you have things like that in, you never know if anyone's going to understand it except you. So it's very, very nice that the readers seem to
be picking
up on that.
When that happens, right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's always the one thing, you know, for an author is to try to get those emotional responses from the readers to be able to say, you know, love it or hate it or whatever. I guess if you get some kind of an emotional response, then you always feel like, hey, I've done my job, because then I'm not forgettable. And that's the one thing that an author never wants to hear, is a character or something was forgettable.
Exactly.
You know, making them think is a good thing.
That's right. Yeah.
So I think I ask this all the time, and you never are going to go there yet, but are you going to go somewhere outside of Lady Emily into today's day and age? Are you going to do anything different down the future? I know you got the next book written, but do you have any other thoughts of outside the series to do something else, maybe anything else?
You know, I always toy with that idea, because I always think that if I wrote a contemporary novel, it would just be like kicking off high-heeled shoes, because I wouldn't have to constantly be checking the OED to see what year a word came into general use. and not have to worry about anachronisms. But, you know, I've got the book for next year finished, and I've got a new contract for 3 more books in the series. So I think I'm going to be pretty occupied with Emily for quite a little while here. But, you know, I always never say never. You know, at some point, you know, I'm sure I will want to do something different.
Yeah. And so where are you going to be? Like, what events are you going to be at? Are you doing any blog tours? Are you doing any video tours or anything else where fans can kind of see, hear you, talk with you?
I'm going to be up in Ann Arbor in a couple weeks at Aunt Agatha's Mystery Shop, which is just one of the most wonderful bookstores in the country. And I'm doing an event with Julia Spencer Fleming up there on November 7th, I think it is. Or no, 8th, November 8th, whatever the Friday is that week. Really, really looking forward to that.
It says the 8th on your website. The 7th,
okay, well,
you're actually going to be in Chicago.
Yes, and I'm going to be in Chicago before the night before. That's right. Numbers. You know, I went into writing so I didn't have to deal with numbers. So.
Exactly. So, and the one thing that I always am very upset with is there's no California dates on here.
I know, and I'm not happy about that. But, you know, VoucherCon next year is in California.
That's right. VoucherCon in Long Beach, we're going to be there because you do know that L.A. is very nice in November and December, right? I mean, I'm just saying. It's better than Arbor,
I know.
I
mean,
we're going to be 83 today and perfectly sunny.
Well, I can't complain today because today we've got 50s. I think it's supposed to be in the mid-50s, and it's gorgeously sunny. It's one of those perfect autumn days.
Yeah, but 50, 80, I don't know. Maybe if you're saying 50 to Siberia, then it looks better, but I don't know.
No, so, we're never going to beat you on weather.
Yeah, that's for sure. But I'll tell you what, Tasha, it's always such a pleasure to have you on and speak with you and see your latest books that come out. And I just want to thank you again so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much for having me. You know, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. It is the one thing that I just look forward to the most when I've got a new book out is getting to talk to you.
Oh, and that's one of the best compliments, like I said, I've ever received. So
well,
I want to thank you so much again, and it's great. And we'll say hi to Tom Robbins because he might be listening now.
Oh, yes. Hello to Tom. He is fantastic.
Yeah. Met you in a coffee shop. That's one of the greatest stories when he told me that.
It is. It's really good. Yeah. Well, you know, good things happen in coffee shops.
Exactly. All right, Tasha, you have a good one. We will talk with you later. Enjoy.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Tasha Alexander, New York Times bestselling author. Her latest book is called Behind the Shattered Glass, Book 8 in her Lady Emily series. Go to TashaAlexander.com. for a lot more information on exactly what she has going on. I also want to say that Thriller Fest is open for registration. Thriller Fest is going to be going on July 8th through the 12th. Go to thrillerfest.com for more information on that. Girls, Guns, and Gangsters, that's what you get in the new book from Brian Anthony and Bill Walker. It's called Abe Lincoln, Public Enemy Number 1. You can check out Lincoln publicenemy.com for more information on that. Whatever you do, don't turn on your lights. Get the latest book by Mike Pace called Deadlight. Check out MikePaceBooks.com for more information on that. And find out why New York Times bestselling author Brad Thor calls Ron Turpiny a fabulous writer by getting his latest book, Cloud Cover. Go to RonTurpiny.com. That's TERPENING.com. And In the Bleak Midwinter is the latest book by paranormal thriller writer M.R. Sellers. And check it out and many more books by M.R. by going to MRSellers.com. That's SELLARS.com. We are pleased that we are going to have Peter James come on here as our next guest, and he will be joining us shortly. So in the meantime, we will leave you with this little musical interlude. Hold on, please. Welcome back, everybody. After the break, again, we want to thank Tasha Alexander for being our guest here on the show. And now we're going to go here to our next guest, best-selling, international best-selling author. His name is Peter James. I'm sure many of you have read his books, which are, without a doubt, one of the it's always one of the highlights of the year to see his books come out. And so we want to welcome Peter to the show. So, Peter, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Thank you. Yeah, very good. Thanks. I'm in England at the moment with a horrible deadline of 2 weeks left to finish my next great, great novel. So I'm working around the clock at the moment.
And, hey, you know, I'm glad we got the time zone thing kind of worked out. So that's good to be able to have you on here today. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about your, you know, your latest book came out in June, Dead Man's Time. What can you kind of tell us that's, like, not on the back cover inside the book here with your Roy Graves crime series?
Well, Dead Man's Time, I guess what's not on the cover is the story idea was given to me by a New York detective called Pat Lanigan, who I got friendly with when I was working on the fourth Roy Graves novel, Dead Man's Footsteps. Pat was one of the very first people on the scene at 9/11, and that book I wrote about a guy who faked his disappearance during 9/11. And Pat and I became some good friends, and he's Irish-American, and he told me, I've always been interested in the kind of New York gang wars, and particularly the kind of Irish and Italian mafia. And about 3 years ago, he kind of dropped a minor bombshell. He said, well, I don't think I ever told you. He said, my great uncle was Dinny Meehan, who was head of the White Hand Gang, which was the Irish mafia from about 1910 to 1920. And Dinny Meehan, I don't know how I'm sure some of the listeners know a lot about the kind of the early history, but really from about 1900, in fact, about 1850 to 1925, New York was largely controlled by the Italian, by the Irish mafia. It was originally the Dead Rabbit Society, then became the White Hand Gang, and the Italians had the Black Hand Gang. And Dinny Meehan was the guy who threw Al Capone out of New York, which is why Capone ended up in Chicago, and didn't actually return to New York and take it over till 1925. And Pat said, you know, Dinny Meehan was shot dead in his bed in 1920 in front of his four-year-old son. And his wife was also shot. And in fact, the son went on to become a famous basketball player. And Pat said, you know, I've never let anybody see this material. And if it might interest you for a book, you'd be welcome to have a look. So I went to New York and I spent 4 days going through all the archive material. And it just gave me the idea for a story of sort of connecting New York in the 1920s with London and Brighton in England in 2012.
You know, I remember watching the movie, and I don't know if you did, Gangs of New York, which was really the first kind of eye-opening experience from that time, because I really had no idea about how the gang violence and how the things and the struggles, of course, would happen in New York, because a lot of the focus back in the 20s was more on, you know, the Capones and all those kinds of things that were going on with Prohibition. So how much research and things were you able to do it, and you kind of go back and you find, you know, about all those things, almost kind of a lost time in New York that doesn't really get talked about a lot in American history?
It doesn't. Pat had this trunk in his home, which I just kind of rummaged through. And I mean, it was fascinating because there was a lot of, inside the Irish gangs, there was a lot of kind of internecine warfare. There was a guy called Wild Bill Lovett, who was, we had Dinny Meehan, who was kind of head of the White Hand Gang, and this guy called Wild Bill Lovett, who was kind of like second in command, and there was a guy with a wooden leg called Peg Leg. Nobody ever quite knew whether it was the Italian mafia or whether it was Lovett who actually murdered Meehan. His wife survived, and she refused ever to speak to Lovett again. And I learned an interesting expression, which is, you've probably heard that expression, go take a long walk down a short pier. And that comes from the way that the Irish mafia had a dispatching of their enemies. It was one of the piers underneath Brooklyn Bridge now is. And they would sort of famously walk with their victims to the end of the pier, and there'd be sort of four guys who'd walk down and three would walk back.
And so
I love that. The first part of Dead Man's Time starts in New York in that sort of gang time. And then it basically the nut of the story is that my character, he's a sort of lieutenant in the White Hand Gang, and he's got this 5-year-old son. And every night when they go to bed, he reads his son a bedtime story. And he's got this beautiful Patek Philippe watch with a man in the moon phase, which he's probably stolen from somewhere. And every night he tells his son a story about the man in the moon. And when the father disappears and the mother's shot, the son is 5 years old and he has an 8-year-old sister, and they have an aunt who's the only surviving relative, and she decides to take them back to their native island for safety. And they're about to board a ship, the Mauritania, down on the wharf, and a messenger boy turns up, and he's got a carrier bag, and in the bag is the father's watch, which is now busted, and the father's gun, and a newspaper cutting with 12 numbers and a cryptic message on. And the story then moves to 2012 in England, and there's been a very nasty burglary in an elderly woman's house, and £10 million worth of antiques have been taken, including this very rare Patek, still broken Patek Philippe watch. And she was the little girl who started the story, and her brother, who was 5 years old, is now 95, multimillionaire antiques dealer, still a very active 95-year-old. And he is, A, horrified about what's happened to his sister, but equally, he wants that watch back. It's the only possession of their father's that they had. And he doesn't trust the police to get the watch back. So he basically takes law into his own hands, gets his thug of a son to put a team together to go find whoever took that watch. And the trail takes us from England to the crooked underworld of Spain, and then actually back to New York, where the sort of last third of the book takes place.
Now, the one thing about thriller writers that, of course, you always have to do is you have to keep up this very intense pace. But the one thing that is also very important that you do a very good job with is you also keep the emotional aspect of the characters, because you give them that, you know, that sense of, you know, maybe things won't work out or things to that effect. Do you consciously, when you're sitting there writing, do you consciously think of the emotional aspect between the characters and how they're going to interact together, along with keeping the pace so fierce? Are you there?
Hello?
Hello, did you hear me?
I the line dropped for a second. Sorry, Earl. Can you repeat?
Okay, that's okay. Okay, yeah. So like I said, as a thriller writer, you have to keep up such an intense pace. But the one good thing that you're able to do also is you have a very good emotional aspect between the characters within. You know, there's a lot of struggle. There's a lot of things that go on. So when you're writing, as long as keeping the pace fierce, how are you able to also, you know, consciously keep that emotion within the characters together to just make it all that much more well-rounded?
I've always felt that emotion is an essential part of writing. I think that whenever you read a book that you really like, it's not just the story you remember, it's how that book made you feel. And I think that you have to care for characters. I learned a long time ago that you should try and make your reader care about every character, not just the good guys. Yeah, I think a classic example of that is Hannah. You know, the guy is a monster, but actually everybody likes him. Everybody has a certain degree of empathy for him. And I think that, you know, if you go back historically in fiction, someone like Dracula, again, the guy's an absolute monster. You know, he kills people and drinks their blood, and yet we kind of rather like him because he's got charm and a bit of style. So I try very hard in every character I write to have, if you like, an element of empathy for him that the reader can, you know, find something good even in somebody really bad.
Yeah, and I think that that's very important, you know, also. And again, we're speaking here with author Peter James, and it's peterjames.com is his website to find out more information about his latest book that came out, Dead Man's Time. It's the ninth in the Roy Grace crime series. So now that book nine has come out, and you know, Roy's been, you know, doing this for quite some time, what's the one element of the book that, you know, in Dead Man's Time that you wanted to maybe change things up a little bit? You wanted to, you know, do something a little different with Roy, so when fans read it, they're kind of like, wow, you know, I didn't really kind of expect to see that coming.
I guess two things. One is that I think that it's the first time that I've really gone back in time a long way in a novel. So I think, you know, kind of starting a kind of contemporary crime novel actually in 1922 in New York was kind of a lot of fun, and I enjoyed that and researching it. I think the other thing fans are going to enjoy is quite a development with Roy's missing wife, Sandy. For those who don't know the kind of Roy Grace books, the first time we meet Roy Grace in Dead Simple, which is the first in the series, we learn that Roy is coming up to his 39th birthday. He's a very successful homicide detective in Brighton in England. 10 years earlier, on his 30th birthday, he came home from work to find his wife, Sandy, who he loved and adored, had vanished off the face of the earth. And for 9 years, he's been looking for her. Although he still functions very effectively as a homicide detective, he's dogged by this private puzzle of his own that he cannot solve. You know, he doesn't know whether she was abducted, whether she ran off with a lover, whether she had an accident. You know, he's even been to mediums and clairvoyants to try to find her. And he is now moving forward in a new relationship. He's taken steps to have Sandy declared dead, legally dead. We start to see that perhaps she might not be dead after all, without saying too much.
Right. Right, and that's one of the things, you know, kind of wrapping things up. And you decided, so when you decided that you were going to put Roy Grace kind of into this plot and wanting to do this instead of making a standalone, What was one of your biggest challenges when you started to go through and write Dead Man's Time?
It's not so much a specific challenge with Dead Man's Time. I kind of feel, I remember when I was a kid, and a lot of my favorite authors who wrote series characters, or just series of books, and Alistair MacLean would be one. I always thought, you know, they had a huge success, and then it was almost as if they got lazy, and their latter books tailed off. And I've always tried, with the Roy Grace novel I write, to raise the bar. And I think the biggest challenge of all is that, although it's a series, each of the books is a standalone. So I try to make sure that anyone picking up any of the books for the first time would have a great read and we'll be able to pick up on anything else that's happened in the past. And I guess that's the biggest challenge, is to make each book be a complete and satisfying standalone for any reader.
Yeah, that's always one way, especially when, you know, when everybody sits and says, and they hear, oh, this is book 9 in the series, well, why should I kind of start now? But I think that it's very good that, you know, authors decide, hey, you know, you can still read book 9, then you can go to 3, you can go to 5, then to 1. You can kind of jump around however you want to do, because that's kind of the way that you decided to write the series, which is very, you know, which is very smart. And it also makes it that much more interesting for the reader to maybe jump back and forth and kind of see different aspects.
Yes, and I think it's great fun. I mean, the one of the big challenges is, obviously, is trying to describe things so that somebody's read several of the books, they've already kind of read the description, so it's finding new ways and economic ways of describing. The other thing that I think is fun with writing a series is what happens in between the books to the lives of the characters, and that's something I'm kind of looking into right now as well. you know, one of the most popular characters in Roy Grace is the detective sergeant Norman Potting. He's like an old school cop. He's sort of slightly homophobic, slightly racist, you know, always on the verge of being fired, but he's a good detective, so he's kind of kept on. And you know, he's got this sort of constant train wreck of a love life. And I enjoy sort of kind of updating the readers on what's been happening between the books.
And, you know, you're one of those authors because you're from England, and so you live in England, and your books come over to America and other different countries. What makes a fan different in England to the United States? Do they kind of view things a little differently? Do they make different things important, you know, story-wise? What do you see differences-wise between fans in America and England?
I don't really see a difference. I think that people who enjoy good stories enjoy them wherever in the world they live. We love America. I particularly love American crime fiction. I've always been a kind of massive fan, right since I discovered kind of Ed McBain years back. But, you know, I have hugely strong following in Russia and Germany and China. And I think if you're telling a good story, people enjoy it regardless of where they live. And I don't think there's a fundamental difference really in taste between English fans and American fans. I love communicating with fans. I tweet and I Facebook and I have a kind of newsletter. And it's terrific getting feedback. I have a lot of feedback, particularly about Sandy. I had an email recently saying, "Dear Mr. James, I'm a big fan of yours. It was from the States, but I've just worked out that I'm a lot younger than you, which means you're probably going to die before me. I think you've left the secret of what happens to Sandy safely in your publisher's vault."
And so,
I emailed him back, and I challenged him to a running race.
And so, you know, with all of the social media and everything that's out there, like you said, you're getting all that instant feedback. The one thing I've always wondered now with an author is, do you kind of let that instant feedback influence maybe your next book? Because before, you know, before all the social media, you kind of had to wait for maybe a review to come out and be printed, and it could be months before, you know, but now you're getting it days after. Do you kind of let that influence your writing for the next book or anything else, knowing what fans are interested in or what they're saying, what they like, what they don't like?
I think it's really interesting to learn the likes and the dislikes. I wouldn't say that I'm significantly influenced. What I do get from it is a tremendous amount of research. If I want to know anything, one of the first places I now go is Twitter and Facebook. And for instance, I was researching into the criminal world of Marbella in Spain, which is a big, it's a massive seaside town down on the kind of Costa del Sol in Spain, but it's had a reputation ever since the war of being, they call it the Costa del Crime. And there's always been a large number of English villains who've gone and lived out there. And Brighton, where I'm based, is the antique centre of the UK. And there's a massive traffic in stolen high-end antiques. And the first place they end up in is Marbella. And then they get straight up from Marbella. They go, the watches go to Russia, and brown furniture, as they call it, goes to China, and pictures go to America. And I wanted an introduction to somebody who really knew the criminal fraternity in Marbella for this book. And within about 2 hours of posting something on Facebook, I had a whole raft of names. Sorry, did you hear that? The line broke up.
Yeah, I hear you. So go ahead. You can finish.
So I actually, I mean, I've, I'm often asked, do I get scared in my research? And I had one of the really scariest moments, just a very uncomfortable moment. I was in Marbella, and I had an introduction to this an ex-English villain who was kind of living out there running a bar. And I arranged to see him, I'm going back about 18 months, 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, and I arrived at this bar, and it was a sort of outside terrace, and it was like an English pub inside, and I walked in, and there was kind of 6 guys, all with shaven heads and tattoos, wearing kind of singlets, watching football on television. They were kind of worst kind of Brits you never want to see abroad.
Right.
And they all looked, I felt like I'd walked on a set of straw dogs, you know, they kind of all stared at me like total suspicion.
That's funny.
And the guy had come to see me around the bar, was standing down the far end, and I walked up to him and he said, "Oh, it's very nice to meet you, Mr. James. I'm a big fan of your books. I particularly like Dead Man's Grip because I like the torture in it." And he said, "Oh," and then he says, "Your camera, I wouldn't point your camera in that direction. It wouldn't be too happy, you know." And I said, "Oh." He said, "How can I help you?" I said, "Well, tell me your story. You know, how did you come to own a bar in Marbella?" And he tells me his life story, and he basically started life as a bare-knuckle fighter fighting gypsies for money. Then he became a bodyguard, and then a drug dealer, and he fell foul of the Chinese triad gangs in England. And he said, "Oh, I had to leave in a bit of a hurry about 6 years ago. I bought this bar." And I said, "How's business?" He said, "Well, not too good, really. We had a bit of a shooting here last year." I said, "Oh, what happened?" He said, "Well, a couple of regulars." He said, one was a professional Irish hitman, and the other was a former bank robber who just come out of jail. And he said, the bank robber was in here one day with his young girlfriend, and the hitman, goosed her. And the bank robber turned around and called him a nonce. I don't know if you have that expression in America. In England, a nonce is a prison term for a paedophile.
Okay.
Just about the worst thing you could call somebody. And okay. He said the man who told me he'd done 42 hits in his life, he said, he came up to me, he said, "Ken," he said, "I apologize for what's going to happen in advance." Got on his motorbike, went off, came back an hour later, all in the motorcycle in leathers. And the bank robber and his girlfriend were sitting on the terrace having a drink. And he said he shot him in each testicle, then 6 times in the stomach, blew him away. Got back on his motorbike and rode off. And he says 4 hours later, the police arrested him at his house. He's now doing life. And I said, he's done 42 hits, and he loses everything just over being called a name. And he said, that is the criminal mentality, you know, the kind of instability of the criminal mind.
Yeah, I mean, to walk into that and then be you can't make that up. I mean, that's what an incredible story just to get from walking into a bar. I mean, that's got to be incredible. That's incredible.
Okay. And then I said to him, I said, what does it cost out of interest to get somebody whacked in Marbella? And he gave me a wonderful expression. You give a Moroccan a Bin Laden. And I said, what? He said, you give a Moroccan a Bin Laden. And I said, what is a Bin Laden? He said, it's a 500 euro note because it's the scarcest Bin Laden. And he said, somebody from Morocco will come over on the ferry, do the whack for 500 euros, take the night ferry back. We can live on that money for 2 years in Morocco. That's cheap.
Oh, my Lord. Wow. Now, that is what you call hands-on research right there. I mean, that's got to be one of the most incredible stories I think an author has ever told me. I mean, about, like, research and finding things out that way. Wow. So,
I used it in that time, that whole scene's in the book.
Well, I'll tell you what, Peter. It's been such a pleasure to be able to talk to you. I love having you on. This is, I think, the second time that you've been on the radio show, which is just fabulous. And, again, I remind everybody that the book is called Dead Man's Time by international best-selling author Peter James.
and you can go to peterjames.com. So, Peter, again, thank you so much for coming on. It's been fabulous to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me on. Again, a really good time to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks again, Peter. So we'll talk with you later, and enjoy yourself, and, you know, good luck. Stay out of those bars, all right?
I'll try to do that.
Yeah. All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Peter James with his book Dead Man's Time. We are going to take a short break, and we are going to be back with our next guest, and his book is coming out. It's called Rasputin's Shadow. It's coming out on October the 8th. None other than international and best-selling author Raymond Corey. So you can get on, listen to that here in just a second. But first, we do have to say that Paul Parsons brings us his latest Baden-Powell book, Beads, called Beads London. Kirkus and Clarion Review both agree that this book is not to be missed. So check out Paul at pauldparsons.com. John Land comes back strong with his latest book in his Caitlin Strong series called Strong Rain Falling. Harlan Coben calls Caitlin his favorite new series character, so visit johnlandbooks.com for more information. And finally, Steve Alton is out with the Omega Project. Steve is the best-selling author of the Meg series, and you can check out Steve at stevealton.com. So again, we are going to be back here in about a minute or so and with Raymond Corey, and we will see you in just a second. So welcome back, everybody, here to our last segment of Suspense Radio. I want to thank all the authors for coming on. I want to thank you guys for listening. However, whenever and wherever you listen to Suspense Radio, you can find us on Suspense Radio, suspensemagazine.com, Suspense Radio button. We are going to get our brand-new website. It's going to be up in January just for the radio show and Crime and Science Radio. We'll give you all those details when we find that out. But now we want to bring in our last guest here of the show. He is the author of Rasputin's Shadow, came out October 8th. For some reason, I didn't know why, but I thought I was in September, so I said coming out. It's already been out for a couple weeks now, October 8th. He is none other than author Raymond Corey. So, Raymond, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing again?
Hey, thanks for having me again, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. So, and I was a little off because I knew we had spoken in the past, but I thought it was for the Templar Salvation. It was actually for the Devil's Elixir. But now we come here to Rasputin's Shadow, your latest book that's coming out, or latest book that just came out again. I can't get out of the September mode. So can you give us a little bit, you know, insight about the book that might not be on the back cover to kind of give fans the idea of what you have going on here?
Sure. I mean, this is another episode in the tortured life of FBI agent Sean Riley that I like to kind of really mess around and just throwing him into the deep end in all kinds of bizarre situations. So this one finds him, this follows the Elixir, and it's mostly set in New York. It involves, it starts off with a Russian diplomat who jumps out of a fifth-story window, and Wright is assigned to the case. It's visibly the suicide of a Russian diplomat. Very quickly, things aren't what they appear to be. There's a missing couple, a high school science teacher and his wife are missing. There's a Russian FSB agent that we only know as Koshe, who's running around town, and finally other CIA agents. There's all kinds of people involved, and it all seems to link back to something that has its roots in the days of Rasputin, which is the historic of the story, if you like. So as I did in The Last Emperor and the Salvation with other books, there's a story that goes on during the days of Rasputin in the early years of the 1900s in Russia, and that's where that's where the story leads back to.
And so, Rasputin is, of course, a major character in history. A lot of people might not know exactly, who he is, but he's one of those characters, I guess you want to say, infamous for things that he did. So what was kind of your pull in order for, to kind of go this direction at this particular time?
Well, two things, John. The thrust of this book is a present day. The present day thriller is all about mind control and brainwashing. I was really interested in finding out. It's something that was seeded in me towards the end of The Devil's Elixir, and I thought that's something I want to find out more about, and that's going to be the topic of the next book. So I wanted to go back and look at what the CIA and the KGB were doing during the Cold War, all the experiments that they were doing that we've kind of seen versions of in fiction. And if you look at things like The Manchurian Candidate, for instance, so it's that kind of weird, spooky world of manipulation. But I always like to have in my books, I like to explore also something in history that could change our lives today. And in this case, there was a beautiful match between Rasputin, who is had these legendary, unexplained really powers of persuasion, of manipulation of people, and even of healing. He became powerful because he was able to keep the young heir to the throne alive when all the doctors were writing him off and saying he's going to die, several times throughout this little kid's life. The doctors would say he's going to be dead tomorrow, and then Rasputin would come in and he'd put his hands over his head and he'd pray and he'd say, he's going to be fine, and the next day the boy would start recovering. So there were all these kind of unexplained things about Rasputin's life that really worked well for the story, and I thought this would be fun to explore more in detail and find out, what really happened back then, what was he really about?
Right, and I grew up kind of more along the tail end of the Cold War, but wasn't that just a really great time? I mean, it was one of those situations that was tense and you just kind of felt it, where in today's day and age, it's a little bit on the different side. So it's great when you're able to go back and kind of relive those moments for people and readers, maybe younger readers who might not understand exactly when they hear what the Cold War is, to kind of get a sense of exactly what was going on. Because, it was really kind of a tense situation. We had fire drills, we had things to go on, if it was going to be nuclear war, were the Russians going to attack, and all these things were going on, and I just felt that it was just a really great, looking back now, it was just a really great time in history, I think.
Well, it was an easier time to understand, in the sense that, of course, we had a really scary nuclear threat out there. But I think, and we came close to it, I guess, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and maybe a couple of times after that. But you kind of knew who the enemy was. That there was this kind of this assured mutual destruction theory thesis, if you like, that kind of realistically, you kind of felt, okay, it's there, but it's you knew who your enemy was. You know, there were was almost like there were rules by which this horrible, you know, game of world domination was played. You know, nowadays we don't have that. You know, now we have these enemies who show up wearing track suits and lugging a backpack, or they board airplanes. I mean, they're everywhere. You don't know what they're going to do next. They're targeting civilians. I think for me, it's a much more insidious, horrific way to live than when you kind of knew you had one enemy. He was a big guy. He had a big stick, and you kind of had to keep each other happy so that, you know, so that everyone stays alive. You had an enemy who was interested in staying alive, you know, which is a big difference to what we have now. But interestingly, you know, we all thought with the breaking of the Berlin Wall and the fall of communism that, you know, this would usher in, you know, who was it, Franz Fukuyama, who said this is the end of history. You know, the great conflict in the world is now gone. You know, now we can move in. And actually, this hasn't been the case at all, even with respect to Russia, because, you know, you've now got a guy who's the president of Russia who was the head of the KGB, and you've got a completely, like, a total Wild West mafia state scenario going on there where anything goes. I mean, for me, it's much scarier than it used to be, because you're back in the territory of no rules, personal gain over, you know, statehood, and I don't know. It's a pretty scary place. I mean, I think we might see more and more thrillers dealing with present day Russia, present day Russian bad guys, what's really going on, which is something I try to explain in the book as well. You know, the way Russia has changed. My main character, my main Russian character, Koshe, you know, this rogue KGB agent, is a guy who's disillusioned. He used to be, a flag-waving kind of believer in the system. He was hardcore KGB, and then he lived through the change. He saw all his bosses, all the generals and everybody just kind of completely roll over, forget about communism, dive headfirst into capitalism, grab as much money as they can, buy big yachts in Monaco and big apartments in London. And he's like, wait a second, what have I been risking my life for all these years?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and you see that kind of, you know, with a lot, agents or people that get out of the military and things, they go, you know, what did I do all this for? I mean, and some of them crack. And so, like, you write your agent, I mean, he just kind of cracks and he just kind of goes the other way. And it's like, you know, he's tired, sick and tired of everything that had happened, and stuff that he thought was fighting for, that, you know, was kind of maybe all a lie. And it just kind of makes you feel very empty. And that's when it makes you very dangerous.
Exactly, because he's no longer, all he cares about now is himself. All he's after is to sort himself out, to set himself up for the future. So he wants to, you know, he wants to cash in, basically. He doesn't care. He doesn't have any allegiance to any cause, to any people, to any nation, to any flag. He's just looking after himself, which means he's a rogue, he's a loose cannon. It's very much harder to pin down what he's going to do. There's no recourse to his superiors to try and, it's much more dangerous.
So give us a little insight here, because you have, you know, you have two agents. You have the FSB agent, and it's Larissa, and I'm not going to pronounce her name correctly.
Larissa Chumicheva.
Chumicheva. And then you have FBI agent Sean Riley. So why them? Why were they the perfect characters to put in Rasputin Shadow?
Well, Riley is someone I created for The Last Templar. Initially, you know, I created him back when I wrote it as a screenplay in 1996. So I've known Sean Riley for a few years. We've kind of bonded. we've had our time.
Yeah.
And I wrote after The Last Templar. I wrote two standalones, The Sanctuary and The Sign, where I didn't feel Riley and his the love of his life, Tess Chaikin, who he met in The Last Templar. I didn't feel that they were the right characters for those stories. So I did two standalones, and then I started to write Devil's Elixir when I came up with the idea for The Templar Salvation, which became my fourth book. So I put Devil's Elixir aside. I wrote Templar Salvation as a sequel to The Last Templar, so I brought Tess and Riley back. And I really enjoyed hanging out with them. So The next book was Devil's Elixir, which I then decided, you know what, actually I'm enjoying these guys. I want to be, and this would work perfectly with Riley, primarily because it's a story where he finds out he has a 4-year-old son that he never knew about. So I thought it would be interesting because I've written 2 books with these characters. I you know, there's a history. Readers are maybe getting to know them, getting attached to them, and this offered an opportunity to make their backstory even. And then with this book, it really followed on. I mean, this book has takes like, you know, an element of Devil's Elixir and an unresolved tiny aspect of that story, and uses it as a separate strand. So there's an opportunity to kind of build more on Tess and Riley, particularly on Riley, of course. I mean, he is my main character, and because I'm writing the first person in his point of view, so it just it just came very, very naturally to continue on from Devil's Elixir with this, and then the next one as well is going to be is going to carry forth, because I've planted a seed in this one that's it's basically the last 10 words of this book that open up a huge hole inside Riley about his past that he's going to really want to find out about.
So that's kind of the teaser for the fans coming for the next one, is that, because that's one thing, you know, because you're writing a series, but, you know, you put a standalone in with here. So, you know, you don't really just write series, is that you kind of leave it a little bit, and then you kind of have the standalone that kind of comes in. So you're able to kind of give fans a lot of that suspense and that buildup, and you're able to, you know, like you just said, hey, you know, the last 10 words of the book put you forward into the next one. So that's kind of, when you were to put all these books together, you would have like a massive volume of novel that would be able to go through Sean Riley's life and everything else that he's been able to go through. And is that kind of what you're thinking while you're kind of not only writing the plots and, of course, the stories, but also developing the characters and going forward?
You know, it's you know, John, it didn't happen by design. It kind of happens in the writing of the story. It's like, you know, in the very last chapter of Devil's Elixir, I saw an opening. You know, he asks, he's face to face with the bad guy or one of the you know, for me they're never good or bad. You know, there's always they're in kind of this you know, I won't say this 50 Shades of Grey area, but they're in this very gray zone of where, you know, but anyway, so he's, you know, he's confronting the guy, and there was an opportunity there for the way that guy answers a question that Riley puts to him could have closed it right there. But that answer could open the door to, and you know, something that Riley wants to find out about in the future. So that's what I did and then the same thing happened in this one. Again, I saw an opportunity to really put a really fun, unrelated teaser about Riley's dad, basically, who we know in The Last Templar. We find out that Riley's dad killed himself when Riley was 10 years old. Riley walked in and found his dad sitting behind his desk with it, you know, having pulled the trigger on himself. So, you know, that was a defining aspect of Riley's life in, you know, as he was set up. And here I found an opportunity it just fit in beautifully. And it wasn't by design. It presented itself, and I thought, oh, this will be great. And it allowed me, it gave me kind of the launch point for what will be the next book. Now, whether that happens again, I don't know. You know, I'll have to see what goes on in the book. But there are two other stories that I'm working on at the moment that I'm desperate to write as well, that don't have Sean and Tess in them, and they're very much standalones, and they're very timely. They're about the world we live in right now. They're about a lot of the anger that's out there at the moment. So I, as you say, I will alternate. There will be books that will be Sean books. There will be Sean and Tess books. And there'll be standalones, which I think is fun. You know, I mean, I think it's fun I like staying fresh and just doing, you know, telling a story I feel like telling, whether it suits Riley or not, is besides the point.
Right, and I think that's very important, you know, for an author to stay fresh, because it's kind of like, I always say, it's kind of like a musical instrument. If you write the same series and you're just, you know, kind of over and over and over, and instead of, unless you're writing mysteries and things like that where the characters change, but it's just the thing that go forward, then it's kind of like, you know, picking up a violin, but all you're doing is playing the same song over and over. Yeah, you play it really, really well, But after a while, it kind of gets a little boring because you're just playing the same song over and over. So you're able to kind of take back and take a fresh look and look at it into the fact of, hey, I'm able to kind of take a year off and look at, you know, look at the characters in maybe a different light. And the world changes so fast that that could also change the books.
Absolutely, and then you know there are other genres that are like, I mean, you know, The Sanctuary, for instance, the second book was kind of, it could have been perceived as a science fiction book. I mean, if you look at in the sense that it's about the core theme of it, it's a thriller. It's, you know, it starts off in Baghdad. It's mostly set in Beirut and in the mountains of Iraq. It's very much a contemporary hard-hitting thriller. But the subject at its core, the mystery at its core, is why do we age? Why do we have to die? Is aging a predetermined genetic? Are we genetically coded to age and die, or is it a combination of medical conditions, of illnesses, if you like? The same way we look at Alzheimer's now as something that can potentially be cured. It's not just turning, you know, becoming senile because you're old and you lose your mind. There's a medical reason for it, and there could be a way to stop it. So I looked at aging in the same way, and there's a lot of research that I was really curious about. What do we know? Is that the case, or are we genetically doomed to age and die? So that conceit, if you have a character in there who has knowledge and who's maybe been able to use it to live longer than we think is normal, that becomes a science fiction conceit. But I didn't want it perceived, or I certainly didn't want to write it as that kind of book. I wanted to write it very much as a thriller grounded in hard science, very much set in today's world. Kind of like, you know, I hugely admire what Michael Crichton used to do, which is, you know, he'd take these amazing conceits, you know, to creating dinosaurs from DNA. And the way he'd write it, he'd put so much, he'd back it up with so much research and so much science that, you know, you'd read it and you go, you're believing it as you're reading it. You think that could be happening on an island down, you know, off the coast of Venezuela where it was. So that's what I tried to do. So the two other stories I'm thinking of writing right now, they're that kind of conceits where, you know, to suddenly throw Riley into that world would feel wrong.
Yeah, and I totally understand exactly what you're saying, just from being able to so many different authors and of course see so many different styles of writing and kind of seeing what works and kind of what doesn't work. And I want to let everybody know that we're speaking here with author Raymond Corey, and the book is called Rasputin's Shadow. Go to RaymondCorey.com, KHOURY.com for a lot more information. And so with the social media, everything, you're getting everything so instant, so updated from fans. You know, they read the book. It came out October the 8th. You know, it's been out now for, you know, what is that, 16 days. So now that you're able to get all of this right away and see the reaction to it, what's the one thing that you're kind of seeing that maybe you're a little surprised that the fans are maybe picking up on this kind of aspect of the book, and you're like, wow, I had no idea that would be important to them?
You know, I guess maybe a couple of things. I mean, one is expected, but it still always surprises me. It's the speed with which fans will read the book. You know, they'll have pre-ordered it. It'll be on their Kindle or in their hands the day it comes out. And I start getting a whole bunch of emails literally the next day. Read it, loved it. When's the next one out? and it's great. I mean, it's so heartening. It's so fulfilling, satisfying to hear that. But at the same time, it's like, wow, it takes a long time to craft these things. And it's a frustration for me that it does, you know, that I can't kind of, you know, bring out 2 year. I'd never want to do that. I can't perceive of how it's done. But so that's one thing. The other thing I've enjoyed with this one, hearing, you know, several people pick up on some of the language in it, some of the descriptions, some of the, it's been kind of fun to see reactions to, you know, when you're writing something, you can tell a story in a million different ways. But for me, I mean, you know, I enjoy kind of little insider things, you know, things where if I'm describing a guy sitting at a table in a restaurant that Riley's going to go to hang out with, I can have fun with, you know, I create him, I can imagine him sitting there opposite me, and I have fun with the way I describe him. So, like, if I'll put in that he's wearing a Wayland Enterprise's XXL t-shirt because he's a hacker, Wayland being the company that, do you remember that whole viral campaign that they created for Prometheus, the sequel to Alien? Do you remember that?
Yeah,
so
that's
Wayland Enterprises was, you know, this kind of this the corporation at the heart of that story, and they created kind of this. So, you know, so this guy, so, you know, that's something that's it's like an obscure reference that, you know, I put in because it puts a little grin on my face as I'm writing it. But I've been getting more and more emails from fans who are picking up on this. I mean, like one thing I usually don't mention this, but it's kind of given me a lot of fun on this book is I named it. I mean, it's a stupid thing, but I named a lot of characters based on the guys I had really read and admired as a kid when I was into comic books, the DC and Marvel icons. So whether it's Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, Neil Adams, all these guys. And I kind of had fun playing around with their names, so combining their names, because they usually worked in duos, you know, so Stan Lee and Jack Kirby always work together. So there'll be a Stan Kirby and a Jack Lee in this book and that kind of thing. So, you know, little insider things that not I don't expect many fans to pick up on, but with this one, I think more and more, I don't know, maybe people are reaching out more to kind of express, you know, that they enjoyed that, which I love. You know, on my Facebook page, I'm very active on it because I love hearing that kind of, you know, personal little comment, you know.
And, you know, this is a big trend that's going on right now, I see, in writing, is two authors teaming up and writing a book together. Is that something that you're interested in?
You know, interested in, definitely. Will it happen? I don't know. We all seem to have very busy schedules, you know, we work in different ways, but I would definitely, you know, yes, in short, we've just done something. I don't know if you're probably aware of this. This book will come out next June or July. It's called Face Off. Do you know about this?
No, maybe. What about?
So Simon & Schuster are bringing out this book called Face Off. Like I said, next June, July, we're going to launch it on Thriller Fest, and it's 11 short stories where 22 of us have gotten together, and in teams of two, we've written short stories using our two main characters. So I did one with Linwood Barclay, Steve Barry did one with James Rollins, Michael Connelly did one with Dennis Lehane. You know, it's a fantastic group of people, and we're all going to meet up next year in June and early July to launch the book. So that was a lot of fun because, like, for that story, Linwood and I decided to work where each one of us would write a chapter and then just send it to the other guy without saying anything about where the story is going. What, you know, just, you know, here's a chapter. Do, you know, you're up to bat.
Right.
And, it was fantastic fun because I'd write my chapter and I'd put some fun things in just to seed some opportunities for him and also to give him some curveballs. You know, so, and it was so interesting to see what he would do with them, and then he would throw them back at me with, you know, a whole bunch of other crazy stuff. And it's like, oh my God, how am I going to deal with this? And it was really interesting to then see how we could bring the story together. Whereas, for instance, I know other teams, I think Michael Colley and Dennis Lehane did this, where they one of them wrote the whole story, and then the other one, you know, edited, like gave it a second pass, and then sent it back to. So it was a whole story that was batted back and forth. You know, that kind of, it's. I mean, that kind of approach, I think, could be fun in writing something together. It'd be difficult to imagine how we'd work on a whole novel in that way.
Right. I mean, just because you know, you just kind of see a lot of it happening now. You see a lot of authors. You know, maybe the bigger name is writing with somebody that, you know, is more of the mid, and they're kind of going back and forth, and I just see a lot more of that happening. And so I didn't know if that was going to be like a new trend or if that was something that you were interested in. So, yeah, I just kind of look and see what the trends are going on, and I just kind of see that happening a lot more now. Yeah.
I know a lot of fans would love, you know, me and Steve are very good friends, and I think given the lives that we've created for Riley and for Cotton Malone, I think there's definitely some fun common ground there that they could enjoy, and we've had fun kind of mentioning the characters know each other because they've mentioned each other in the books, and Steve does that with James Rollins' characters as well. So yeah, I mean, at some point I think it would be a lot of fun to do at some point.
Well, so we got about a minute left. So what else, you know, do you want to tell everybody? What else do you want fans to know about, you know, the not just maybe Rasputin Shadow, but your writing and everything else you got going on?
Well, I just, you know, I just hope they're enjoying the books. I know, you know, the Last Templar kind of put me on the map in a really nice way. I was so grateful to all the, you know, to everyone out there who went out and bought it and enjoyed it. You know, I got so much response to that book. And since then, it's been great. I think, you know, I'm enjoying continuing Riley and his story. So I just hope, you know, I just hope everyone enjoys it. And I'd love to hear from, you know, from everyone if they've read it, enjoyed it, you know, come onto my Facebook page, which is the official page. It's Raymond Curry official page because there's one that's a Wikipedia cut and paste that I don't control. And let me know.
So, Raymond, we want to thank you again so much for coming on and talking about your latest book, Rasputin Shadow. Again, a book that all thriller suspense, you know, readers should definitely not only have the book, but should always be checking out all of your stuff and putting them on your calendar to say, hey, you know, right around October, let's start looking for a Raymond Curry book.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I'm sorry. It's been a bit of a delay with this one. It's taken about 18
That's
months.
Okay.
But the next one won't take that long, I promise that.
Hey, you know what? We'd rather get it right than not, so it's okay. We'll take a delay just to make sure that everything is exactly the way that you want it.
Well, thank you. You know, we had some family health issues I had to deal with, which you know, is always a priority for me. But all's well that ends well.
Fabulous. Well, hey, Raymond, again, thank you so much for coming on, and we will talk with you later. So enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right. Bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Raymond Curry. The book is called Rasputin's Shadow. You can find it out at RaymondCurry.com, K-H-O-U-R-Y.com. We want to thank Tasha Alexander for coming on to the show and talking about her book, Behind the Shattered Glass. And, of course, we had Peter James on, and he was speaking about his latest book. You can go to peterjames.com to find out more information. Go to suspensemagazine.com, click on Suspense Radio, find out our schedule. Crime and Science Radio, Marcia Clark's episode is up and going on, and she was on last Saturday. And you can check out more by clicking on the Crime and Science Radio button to see which episodes are coming up. It's a fabulous show for anyone who wants to know more about crime and science and everything else that goes on behind the scenes. So until then, everybody, we want to thank you all for joining us, and we will see you all next time.